The last time he knocked at our door was one wet morning at 9:05, and I was sleep-logged in me crummy bed as usual. Mam had gone to work that day, so I shouted for him to hold on a bit and then went down to see who it was. There he stood, 6 feet tall and sopping wet, and for the first time in me life I did a spiteful thing that I'll never forgive myself for. I didn't ask him to come in out of the rain, because I wanted him to get double pneumonia and die. I suppose he could have pushed by me and come in if he'd wanted, but maybe he'd got used to asking questions on the doorstep and didn't want to be put off by changing his ground even though it was raining. Not that I don't like being spiteful because of any balmy principle I've got, but this bit of spite, as it turned out, did me no good at all. I should have treated him like a brother I hadn't seen for 20 years, and dragged him in for a cup of tea and a fag, told him about the picture I hadn't seen the night before, asked him how his wife was after her operation, and whether they'd shaved her moustache off to make it, and then sent him, happy and satisfied, out by the front door. But no, I thought, let's see what he's got to say for himself now. He stood a little to the side of the door, either because it was less wet there, or because he wanted to see me from a different angle, perhaps having found it monotonous to watch a bloke's face always telling lies from the same side. "You've been identified," he said, twitching raindrops from his tash. "A woman saw you and your mate yesterday, and she swears blind that you're the same chap she saw going into that bakery." I was dead sure he was still bluffing, because Mike and I hadn't even seen each other the day before, but I looked worried. "She's a menace then to innocent people, whoever she is, because the only bakery I've been in lately is that one up our street to get some cut bread on tick for me mam." He didn't bite on this. "So now I want to know where that money is," as if I hadn't answered him at all. "I think mam took it to work this morning to get herself some tea in the canteen." Rain was splashing down so hard I thought he'd get washed away if he didn't come inside, but I wasn't much bothered and went on. "I remember I put it on the televars last night. It was me only 1 and 3, and I was saving it for a packet of tips this morning, and I nearly had a gibbering black fit just now when I saw it had gone. I was reckoning on it for getting me through today, because I don't think life's worth living without a fag, do you?" I was getting into my stride and beginning to feel good, twigging that this would be my last pack of lies, and that if I kept it up for long enough this time, I'd have the bastards beat. Mike and me would be off to the coast in a few weeks' time, having the fun of our lives, playing at penny football and latching onto a couple of tarts that would give us all they were good for. "And this weather's no good for picking up fag ends in the street," I said, "because they'd be sopping wet. Of course, I know you could dry them out near the fire, but it don't taste the same, you know, all said and done. Rainwater does summat to them that don't bear thinking about. It turns them back into ostods without the taste, though." I began to wonder, at the back of my brainless eyes, why old Copperlugs didn't pull me up sharp and say I hadn't got time to listen to all this. But he wasn't looking at me anymore, and all my thoughts about Skegness went bursting to smithereens in my sludgy loaf. I could have dropped into the earth when I saw what he'd fixed his eyes on. He was looking at it, an ever-loving fiver. And I could only jabber. "The one thing is to have some real fags, because ostods is always better than stuff that's been rained on and dried. And I know how you feel about not being able to find money, because 1 and 3 is 1 and 3 in anybody's pocket. And naturally, if I see it knocking around, I'll get on the blower tomorrow straight away." I thought I'd go down in a fit. 3 greenbacks as well had been washed down by the water, and more were following, lying flat at first after their fall, then getting tilted at the corners by wind and rain spots, as if they were alive and wanted to get back into the dry, snug drain pipe out of the terrible weather. And you can't imagine how I wished they'd be able to. Old Hitlerface didn't know what to make of it, but just kept staring down and down. I thought I'd better keep on talking, though I knew it wasn't much good now. "It's a fact, I know, that money's hard to come by, and half-crowns don't get found on bus seats or in dustbins, and I didn't see any in bed last night, because I'd have known about it, wouldn't I? You can't sleep with things like that in the bed, because they're too hard, and anyway, at first, It took Hitler Boy a long time to catch on. They were beginning to spread over the yard a bit, reinforced by the third colour of a 10-bob note, before his hand clamped itself onto my shoulder. The pop-eyed, pot-bellied governor said to a pop-eyed, pot-bellied member of parliament who sat next to his pop-eyed, pot-bellied whore of a wife that I was his only hope for getting the Borstal Blue Ribbon Prize Cup for long-distance cross-country running All England, which I was. And it set me laughing to myself inside, and I didn't say a word to any pot-bellied, pop-eyed bastard that might give them real hope, though I knew the governor anyway took my quietness to mean he'd got that cup already stuck on the bookshelf in his office, among the few other mildewed trophies. He might take up running in a sort of professional way when he gets out. And it wasn't until he'd said this, and I'd heard it with my own flap tabs, that I realised it might be possible to do such a thing. Run for money, trot for wages on piecework at a bob a puff, rising bit by bit to a guinea a gasp, and retiring through old age at 32 because of lace curtain lungs, a football heart, and legs like varicose beanstalks. But I'd have a wife and cat, and get me grinning long-distance clock in the papers, and have a smashing secretary to answer piles of letters sent by tarts who'd mob me when they saw who I was as I pushed my way into Woolworths for a packet of razor blades and a cup of tea. It was something to think about, all right. And sure enough, the governor knew he'd got me when he said, turning to me as if I would at any rate have to be consulted about it all, "How does this matter strike you then, Smith, my lad?" A line of pot-bellied pop eyes gleamed at me, and a row of goldfish mouths opened and wiggled gold teeth at me. So I gave them the answer they wanted because I'd hold my trump card until later. "It'd suit me fine, sir," I said. "Good lad, good show, right spirit, splendid." "Well," the governor said, "get that cup for us today and I'll do all I can for you. I'll get you trained so that you whack every man in the free world." And I had a picture in me brain of me running and beating everybody in the world, leaving them all behind until I was trotting across a big wide moor alone, doing a marvellous speed as I ripped between boulders and reed clumps, when suddenly, crack, crack, bullets that can go faster than any man running, coming from a copper's rifle planted in a tree, winged me and split me gizzard in spite of my perfect running, and down I fell. The pot bellies expected me to say something else. "Thank you, sir," I said. Told to go, I trotted down the pavilion steps out to the field, because the big cross-country was about to begin, and the two entries from Gunthorpe had fixed themselves early at the starting line and were ready to move off like white kangaroos. The sports ground looked a treat, with big tea tents all round and flags flying and seats for families, empty because no mamma dad had known what opening day meant, and boys still running heats for the 100 yards, and lords and ladies walking from stall to stall, and the Borstal boys' brass band in blue uniforms, and upon the stands the brown jackets of Hucknall, as well as our own grey blazers, and then the Gunthorpe lot with the shirt sleeves rolled. The blue sky was full of sunshine, and it couldn't have been a better day, and all of the big show was like something out of Ivanhoe that we'd seen on the pictures a few days before. "Come on, Smith," Roach, the sportsmaster, called to me. "We don't want you to be late for the big race, eh? Although I dare say you'd catch them up if you were." The others catcalled and grunted at this, but I took no notice, and placed myself between Gunthorpe and one of the Aylsham trustees, dropped on my knees, and plucked a few grass blades to suck on the way round. So the big race it was for them, watching from the grandstand under a fluttering Union Jack, a race for the governor, what he'd been waiting for. And I hoped he and all the rest of his pop-eyed gang were busy placing big bets on me, 100 to 1 to win, all the money they had in their pockets, all the wages they were going to get for the next 5 years. And the more they placed, the happier I'd be. Because here was a dead cert, going to die on the big name they'd built for him, going to go down dying with laughter, whether it choked him or not. My knees felt the cool soil pressing into them, and out of my eye's corner, I saw Roach lift his hand. The Gunthorpe boy twitched before the signal was given. Somebody cheered too soon. Medway bent forward. Then the gun went, and I was away. We went once around the field and then along a half-mile drive of elms, being cheered all the way, and I seemed to feel I was in the lead as we went out by the gate and into the lane, though I wasn't interested enough to find out. The five-mile course was marked by splashes of whitewash, gleaming on gateposts and trunks and stiles and stones, and a boy with a water bottle and bandage box stood every half mile waiting for those that dropped out or fainted. Over the first stile, without trying, I was still nearly in the lead but one. And if any of you want tips about running, never be in a hurry, and never let any of the others know you are in a hurry, even if you are. You can always overtake on long-distance running without letting the others smell the hurry in you. And when you've used your craft like this to reach the two or three up front, then you can do a big dash later that puts everybody else's hurry in the shade, because you've not had to make haste up till then. I ran to a steady jog-trot rhythm, and soon it was so smooth that I forgot I was running, and I was hardly able to know that my legs were lifting and falling, and my arms going in and out, and my lungs didn't seem to be working at all, and my heart stopped that wicked thumping I always get at the beginning of a run. Because, you see, I never race at all. I just run, and somehow I know that if I forget I'm racing and only jog-trot along until I don't know I'm running, I'll always win the race. For when my eyes recognise that I'm getting near the end of the course by seeing a stile or cottage corner, I put on a spurt, and such a fast, big spurt it is, because I feel that up till then I haven't been running and that I've used no energy up at all. And I've been able to do this because I've been thinking. And I wonder if I'm the only one in the running business with this system of forgetting that I'm running because I'm too busy thinking. And I wonder if any of the other lads are on the same lark, though I know for a fact that they aren't. Off like the wind along the cobbled footpath and rutted lane, smoother than the flat grass track on the field, and better for thinking because it's not too smooth. And I was in my element that afternoon, knowing that nobody could beat me at running, but intending to beat myself before the day was over. For when the governor talked to me of being honest when I first came, he didn't know what the word meant, or he wouldn't have had me here in this race, trotting along in shimmy and shorts and sunshine. He'd have had me where I'd have had him if I'd been in his place, in a quarry breaking rocks until he broke his back. At least old Itlerface, the plain-clothes Dick, was honester than the governor, because he at any rate had had it in for me and I for him. And when my case was coming up in court, a copper knocked at our front door at 4 o'clock in the morning and got my mother out of bed when she was paralytic tired, reminding her she had to be in court at dead on 9:30. But it was the finest bit of spite I've ever heard of, but I would call it honest, the same as my mam's words were honest when she really told that copper what she thought of him, and called him all the dirty names she'd ever heard of, which took a 30 minutes and woke the terrace up. I trotted on along the edge of a field bordered by the sunken lane, smelling green grass and honeysuckle, and I felt as though I came from a long line of whippets trained to run on two legs, only I couldn't see a toy rabbit in front, and there wasn't a collier's cosh behind to make me keep up the pace. I passed the Gunthorpe runner, whose shimmy was already black with sweat, and I could see the corner of the fenced-up copse in front, where the only man I had to pass to win the race was going all out to gain the halfway mark. Then he turned into a tongue of trees and bushes where I couldn't see him any more, and I couldn't see anybody. And I knew what the loneliness of the long-distance runner running across country felt like, realizing that as far as I was concerned, this feeling was the only honesty and realness there was in the world, and I knowing it would be no different ever, no matter what I felt at odd times, and no matter what anybody else tried to tell me. The runner behind me must have been a long way off because it was so quiet, and there was even less noise and movement than there had been at 5 o'clock of a frosty winter morning. It was hard to understand, and all I knew was that you had to run, 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 without knowing why you were running, but on you went, through fields you didn't understand, and into woods that made you afraid, over hills without knowing you'd been up and down, and shooting across streams that would have cut the heart out of you had you fallen into them. And the winning post was no end to it, even though crowds might be cheering you in, because on you had to go before you got your breath back, and the only time you stopped really was when you tripped over a tree trunk and broke your neck, or fell into a disused well and stayed dead in the darkness forever. So I thought, they aren't going to get me on this racing lark, this running and trying to win, this jog-trotting for a bit of blue ribbon, because it's not the way to go on at all, though they swear blind it is. You should think about nobody and go your own way, not on a course marked out for you by people holding mugs of water and bottles of iodine in case you fall and cut yourself, so that they can pick you up and get you moving again, even if you want to stay where you are. On I went out of the wood, passing the man leading without knowing I was going to do so, rhythmically running in my greyhound effortless fashion, knowing I'd won the race, though it wasn't half over, won it if I wanted to, and could go on for 10 or 15 or 20 miles if I had to, and drop dead at the finish of it, which would be the same in the end as living an honest life like the governor wanted me to. It amounted to win the race and be honest. And on trotting I went, having the time of my life, loving my progress because it did me good and set me thinking, which by now I like to do, but not caring at all when I remembered that I had to win this race as well as run it. And I knew I could do both, because my legs had carried me well in front, now coming to the short cut down the bramble bank and over the sunken road, and would carry me further, because they seemed to be made of electric cable and easily alive to keep on slapping at those ruts and roots. But I'm not going to win, because the only way I'd see I came in first would be if winning meant I was going to escape the coppers after doing the biggest bank job of my life. But winning means the exact opposite. No matter how they try to kill or kid me, means running right into their white-gloved, wall-barred hands and grinning mugs and staying there for the rest of me natural long life of stone-breaking anyway, but stone-breaking in the way I want to do it and not in the way they tell me. Another honest thought that comes is that I could swing left at the next hedge of the field and under its cover beat my slow retreat away from the sports ground winning post. I could do 3 or 6 or a dozen miles across the turf like this and cut a few main roads behind me so they'd never know which one I'd taken. And maybe on the last one, when it got dark, I could thumb a lorry lift and get a free ride north with somebody who might not give me away. But no, I said I wasn't daft, didn't I? I won't pull out with only 6 months left. And besides, there's nothing I want to dodge and run away from. I only want a bit of my own back on the in-laws and pot bellies, by letting them sit up there in their big posh seats and watch me lose this race. Though as sure as God made me, I know that when I do lose, I'll get the dirtiest crap and kitchen jobs in the months to go before my time is up. I won't be worth a threepenny bit to anybody here, which will be all the thanks I get for being honest in the only way I know. For when the governor told me to be honest, it was meant to be in his way, not mine. And if I kept on being honest in the way he wanted and won my race for him, he'd see I got the cushiest 6 months still left to run. But in my own way, well, it's not allowed. And if I find a way of doing it such as I've got now, then I'll get what for in every mean trick he can set his mind to. And if you look at it in my own way, who can blame him? For this is war. And ain't I said so? And when I hit him in the only place he knows, he'll be sure to get his own back on me for not collaring that cup when his heart's been set for ages on seeing himself standing up at the end of the afternoon to clap me on the back as I take the cup from Lord Earwig or some such chinless wonder with a name like that. And so I'll hit him where it hurts a lot, and he'll do all he can to get his own back, tit for tat, though I'll enjoy it most because I'm hitting first and because I planned it longer. I don't know why I think these thoughts are better than any I've ever had, but I do. I don't care why. I suppose it took me a long time to get going on all this, because I've had no time and peace in all my bandit life. And now my thoughts are coming, pat. And the only trouble is I often can't stop, even when my brain feels it's got cramp, frostbite and creeping paralysis all rolled into one, and I have to give it a rest by slap-dashing down through the brambles of the sunken lane. And all this is another uppercut I'm getting in first at people like the governor, to show how, if I can, his races are never won, even though some bloke always comes unknowingly in first, how in the end the governor is going to be doomed, while blokes like me will take the pickings of his roasted bones and dance like maniacs around his Borstal's ruins. And so this story is like the race, and once again I won't bring off a winner to suit the governor, no. I'm being honest like he told him to, without him knowing what he means, though I don't suppose he'll ever come in with a story of his own, even if he reads this one of mine and knows who I'm talking about. I've just come up out of the sunken lane, kneed and elbowed, thumped and bramble-scratched, and the race is two-thirds over. And a voice is going like a wireless in my mind, saying that when you've had enough of feeling good like the first man on earth of a frosty morning, and you've known how it is to be taken bad like the last man on earth on a summer's afternoon, then you get at last to being like the only man on earth, and don't give a bogger about either good or bad, but just trot on with your slippers slapping the good dry soil that at least would never do you a bad turn. Now the words are like coming from a crystal set that's broken down, and something's happening inside the shell case of my guts that bothers me, and I don't know why or what to blame it on. A grinding near my ticker, as though a bag of rusty screws is loose inside me, and I shake them up every time I trot forward. Now and again I break my rhythm to feel my left shoulder blade by swinging a right hand across my chest as if to rub the knife away that has somehow got stuck there. But I know it's nothing to bother about, but more likely it's caused by too much thinking that now and again I take for worry. For sometimes I'm the greatest worrier in the world, I think, as you twigged, I'll bet, from me having got this story out, which is funny anyway, because my mum didn't know the meaning of the word, so I don't take after her. Though Dad had a hard time of worry all his life, up to when he filled his bedroom with hot blood and kicked the bucket that morning when nobody was in the house. I'll never forget it, straight I won't, because I was the one that found him. I often wished I hadn't. Back from a session on the fruit machines at the fish and chip shop, jingling my three lemon loot to a nail-dead house, as soon as I got in I knew something was wrong. Stood leaning my head against the cold mirror above the mantelpiece, trying not to open my eyes and see my stone-cold clock, because I knew I'd gone as white as a piece of chalk since coming in, as if I'd been got at by a Dracula vampire, and even my penny pocket winnings kept quiet on purpose. Gunthorpe nearly caught me up. Birds were singing from the briar hedge, and a couple of thrushes flew out like lightning into some thorny bushes. Corn had grown high in the next field and would be cut down soon with scythe and mow. But I never wanted to notice much while running in case it put me off my stroke. So by the haystack I decided to leave it all behind and put on such a spurt, in spite of nails in my guts, that before long I'd left both Gunthorpe and the birds a good way off. I wasn't far now from going into that last mile and a half like knife through margarine. But the quietness I suddenly trotted into between two pickets was like opening my eyes underwater and looking at the pebbles on a stream bottom, reminding me again of going back that morning to the house in which my old man had croaked, which is funny because I hadn't thought about it at all since it happened, and even then I didn't brood on it. I wonder why. I suppose that since I started to think on these long-distance runs, I'm liable to have anything crop up and pester at my tripes and innards. So anyway, after a bit I went upstairs one step at a time, not thinking anything about how I should find Dad and what I'd do when I did. But now I'm making up for it by going over the rotten life Mam led him ever since I can remember, knocking on with different men even when he was alive and fit, and she not caring whether he knew it or not. And most of the time he wasn't so blind as she thought, and cursed and roared and threatened to punch her tab, and I had to stand up to stop him even though I knew she deserved it. What a life for all of us. Well, I'm not grumbling, because if I did, I might just as well win this bleeding race, which I'm not going to. Though if I don't lose speed, I'll win it before I know where I am, and then where would I be? Now I can hear the sports ground noise and music as I head back for the flags and the lead-in drive, the fresh new feel of underfoot gravel going against the iron muscles of my legs. I'm nowhere near puffed despite that bag of nails that rattles as much as ever, and I can still give a big last leap like gale force wind if I want to. But everything is under control, and I know now that there ain't another long-distance cross-country running runner in England to touch my speed and style. Our doddering bastard of a governor, our half-dead gangrene gaffer, is hollow like an empty petrol drum, and he wants me and my running life to give him glory, to put in him blood and throbbing veins he never had, wants his pot-bellied pals to be his witnesses as I gasp and stagger up to his winning post as he can say, "My Borstal gets that cup, you see. I win my bet because it pays to be honest and try to gain the prizes I offer to my lads, and they know it, have known it all along. They'll always be honest now because I made them so." And his pals will think, "He trains his lads to live right after all. He deserves a medal, but we'll get him made a sir." And at this very moment, as the birds come back to whistling, I can tell myself I'll never care a sod what any of the chinless, spineless in-laws think or say. They've seen me, and they're cheering now, and loudspeakers set around the field like elephant's ears are spreading out the big news that I am well in the lead and can't do anything else but stay there. But I'm still thinking of the outlaw death my dad died, telling the doctors to scat from the house when they wanted him to finish up in hospital, like a bleeding guinea pig. He got up in that bed to throw them out and even followed them down the stairs in his shirt, though it was no more than stick and skin. They tried to tell him he'd want some drugs, but he didn't fall for it and only took the painkiller that Mam and I got from a herb seller in the next street. It's not till now that I know what guts he had, and when I went into the room that morning, he was lying on his stomach with the clothes thrown back, looking like a skinned rabbit, his grey head resting just on the edge of the bed. And on the floor must have been all the blood he'd had in his body, right from his toenails up, for nearly all of the lino and carpet was covered in it, thin and pink.